I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source from the Watson Institute at Brown University, an American conversation, we call it, with global attitude. This one is with Colm Tóibín, the celebrated Irish novelist with the hypnotic voice and a big American hit just out titled Brooklyn. The new book is a heartbreaker about an Irish girl from a small town who comes to America about 50 years ago and finds, to her grief, that she cannot stay. The conversation here picks up on another one 5 years ago. The link is Henry James. Tóibín called him the master in his breakthrough novel of 2004 about the conflicted heart of an immortal writer. And now the heroine of Brooklyn, the Irish girl come to the States, cannot help but remind you in many inside-out ways of Isabel Archer, the all-time Henry James heroine who emigrated the other way, a rich American girl who went to Europe to find her destiny and, as it turned out, the wrong husband. Colm Tóibín, we met the last time at Henry James's gravesite with the whole James family out there when you were touring with The Master. I haven't got over that book. I read the new one, Brooklyn, about Eilish, and I keep thinking of not only you and Henry James, but of Eilish and Isabel Archer in her own way. They go in different directions, but with great courage, with great vulnerability that they're not even quite aware of. Was this in your mind as you composed Eilish?
It wasn't exactly in my mind, but I suppose I was aware of the two books that Henry James wrote in those few years, one being Washington Square, in which he dealt with a young woman who was ostensibly not very powerful or intelligent, but whose emotions ran very deep. And it dealt with her in a very intense sort of way. And then he opened that out very much into Isabel Archer. I mean, I suppose I was aware that I was dealing with a young woman, as Henry James said about Isabel Archer, confronting her destiny, but doing so almost ironically, in the sense that she doesn't confront anything and she doesn't really have a destiny. And that I was dealing with something that is one of the great sort of almost hidden subjects, oddly enough, which is the subject of Irish emigration. That although we know so much about it, we end up knowing so little about it, that there are very few novels about it, for example, that there are a good number of memoirs about it, and that the children of the emigrants tended to become Eugene O'Neill. You know, they didn't end up writing about their parents' actual journey over and what those initial years were like. And but the James thing was interesting for me too, in that James deals with the dramatizations of secrecy and of people having things they keep to themselves and that if known will be explosive. And so too in this book, there are two sisters, and they both keep things deep in themselves. And the reader wonders, oh, just tell, just say, it'll be all right. But neither of them wishes to do so, you know. And so I was interested in what that withholding, in the dramatic power of withholding, which is something I think I learned a lot about from James, both in his, you know, in his own life, indeed, but also in his work, perhaps more in his work.
I'm thinking, by the way, Edna O'Brien's last novel that I read was about an Irish woman, her mother perhaps, who had come and gone back, as Eilish does. But come back to Isabel Archer in The Portrait of a Lady. In what sense is Eilish, you said an ironic contrast, but maybe almost a parody? She has no fortune. She has no great houses that she's coming to. She has no introductions to this panoply of possible men, and yet there is something there.
Yes, I think what it is that she has a rich way of noticing, and almost a novelist way of noticing, that nothing escapes her, that if she's in a room and there are five people, she's the least likely to speak, but she's the most likely to notice what the other four are doing, and that she's constantly in the position of watcher. And in that sense, she's close to Isabel Archer, who is always noticing, who's always alert to other people's feelings. And so, yes, in that sense, also, she's not just ironically related to Isabel Archer, but actually closely.
Somebody said, I forget who, that Isabel Archer was James's reversioning of Dorothea Brooke in Middlemarch. In what sense is this process sort of still unwinding?
Well, I was careful. James also wrote, there's a late story called In the Cage, in which he wrote about a young woman having a job, which was a menial job, And, you know, the whole business of, in Brooklyn, Eilish isn't a reader. She doesn't look at paintings. She doesn't think about the future of society. So she's not like Dorothea or Isabel in that sense of being, you know, ambitious for herself in an obvious sort of way. But what she does have is a quiet way of holding in what she sees and of also attracting people towards her in ways that she doesn't manipulate. But she's certainly not as intelligent in an obvious way as Dorothea, or as ambitious in a sort of sensuous way as Isabel. But I am alert to those books, and I realise that the 19th century creation of the female heroine is both shadowing and nurturing.
Let me think about that. Meaning
that you have to evade it in certain ways and be careful that you're not just following it, but also incredibly useful in that you realise what a powerful thing it is to give someone who's ostensibly powerless the power of central position in a book or a play.
Isabel Archer was carrying a kind of American freight and power with her, and her insistence was that she would choose. Didn't choose right among the men in the end, it turned out. But what is the corresponding or the inversion or the ironic counterpart in Eilish's coming to America?
Oh, I think that whereas James would have got some of the ideas about Isabel from his cousin Minnie Temple, but also would have got them from reading Emerson and Thoreau and whole ideas of how Americans were not so interested in rank and class as, say, English women would have been. My woman is Irish in the sense that she's powerless, that there simply isn't any money and there isn't any work and there's no inherited money, and that she really will have to go. So to that extent, her sensibility is, I think, deeply informed by a sort of powerlessness. But also, she's sensitive, she's open, and she's not generally assertive, which is complicated in that she can be assertive sometimes. And she's also got a particular skill with numbers. In other words, every time she ever comes across, you know, anything to do with accounting, she can actually do it. She can organise anything. She has a particularly interesting sort of mind, which is certainly not my mind, but, you know, she's not a reader or somebody who would have any interest in philosophical positions.
I wonder, were you suggesting that the Irish immigrant stories, the guts of it, are yet to be told and we might yet read them?
No, what I'm saying is, I suppose, that the emigrants in general were so busy creating a new life that they weren't really going to become novelists, and they weren't going to describe it firsthand and put it onto the characters in their novels. I notice in recent years it has been done by figures like, as you say, Edna O'Brien, by Joe O'Connor, Joseph O'Connor, a novel called Star of the Sea, because perhaps all three of us, Joseph O'Connor, Edna O'Brien and myself, have been travelling back and forth between the United States and Ireland and can sort of try and imagine what it might have been like to have done that 50 years earlier. But the emigrants themselves, while there were memoirs left, and there are some texts that, you know, some short stories, some plays and some novels, it has not been as huge a presence in Irish writing as you think it should have been, considering the importance it's had. And part of the reason for that is that people who were involved in it were simply too busy.
Last question. You travel in such wonderful company among writers, but I'm thinking of Henry James above all. What's it like after these years still to be working that huge terrain?
Oh, you just work slowly, you see. The thing is, you never think about that at all. If you thought about that, you would really lose everything. You're thinking about the next detail and the next rhythm. And if you started thinking about larger pictures like that, I think you'd end up writing philosophy or something.
Colm Devine, it's a great pleasure to see you again and to read Brooklyn. Thank you.
Okay.
Cut to the Cambridge Cemetery outside Boston, where Colm Devine and I spoke the last time. Henry James, his parents, his brother William, his sister Alice, are all interred there together. I was half expecting a voice from the grave to unlock this attachment, Toy Beans as a writer, mine as a reader, to the master.
Colm Devine, it's a joy to read your book and a pleasure to be talking about Henry James at the James family burial site here in the Cambridge Cemetery. Who knows, they may want to speak to us this afternoon. I hadn't realized until Lewis Menand's book that when William James died, 1910, Henry stayed in his house in Cambridge for 6 weeks because William had said, I'm going to be trying to get in touch with you. They were spiritualists. They were a little spooky.
Henry was more skeptical than either William or William's wife Alice were. And Alice James herself, in other words, Alice the sister, rather than Alice the sister-in-law, Alice, Henry James's sister, was most skeptical indeed. And when her brother asked her to send from England a lock of her hair so they could use it in a séance, she sent a lock of a friend's hair and cackled with joy as they came back to the results. Oh, it was so useful. Oh, we got so much information. But they did believe, William James and his wife Alice did go to seances, they did go to mediums, as many people of their generation in various countries, including England and France, did. It was a very common thing at that time. Henry was always watching, always looking at the world from a window. His own involvement, he was never directly involved in a seance, but when William told him that his mother had come back through a medium, he was most concerned that she wasn't at rest, and most concerned what his mother had to say. But William and Alice were more involved, really.
It's one of the great scenes in your book, late on, when William and his wife Alice come to Henry in London and said, we've heard from Mother.
Yes.
And she wants you to know that, A, you're going to be the last of the litter alive, and that she will see you again. It's a beautiful thing.
Yes, what actually happened was that when William James was dying, he said to his wife Alice, he still thought of Henry as someone who couldn't defend himself or look after himself. When Harry, as he called him, is dying, will you go to him? Will you promise to go to him and be with him when he's dying so he will not be alone in England? Because, of course, by that time, Harry was the last. And Alice said she would, and when Henry James was dying in England, his sister-in-law, Alice, whom he had enormous respect for, arrived and sort of took over the household and ran it with great care and attention and was with him when he was dying. But the business of seeing his mother, that she wasn't at fully at rest and that she'd messages for him, certainly disturbed him.
We got a lot of ground to cover before the death of Henry James. Your book focuses on the years roughly 1895 to 1900, and it brings it up right to the eve of one of my favorite, everybody's favorite Henry James stories, The Beast in the Jungle. And you, by this time, he hasn't written it yet, but you've sketched in all of the roots of that amazing story. I'd like you to talk about it.
The story is odd. It's about a man who tells a woman years earlier that something ghastly and dreadful will happen to him in the future. He knows this, but he doesn't know when or in what form it will come. They meet years later and she asks him, has it happened? What is it? What form will it take? And they become friends. What emerges is that his failure to love her, to see what could come from her, or from anybody else indeed, in other words, his own solitude, is growing almost like a crust around him. And the dreadful thing is happening almost as he speaks, that his own solitude, his own interest in keeping the world at bay, is what will come to destroy him. And of course, when she dies in the story, he realizes this much more gravely, and the reader does. Now, the possibility remains, you see, that this story is his most deeply autobiographical work. It's the one where he really gives the game away about what he himself sacrificed for his art, for his solitude, for his industry. That he fled from this family of his. He loved them so much that he left them. And he never came back very much. The odd visit, a lot of letters, and certainly the death of his parents affected him deeply. But he longed to get away from them. He stayed away from them. He lived alone. He had servants, but he never shared his household with anybody. And when anybody came close to him, he made sure that they were kept at bay, especially a woman, an American novelist called Constance Fenimore Woolson, who came rather close to him, but not close enough because he wasn't having that. So the story is written when he's approaching the beginning of his 60s, and he realizes that he's never had love. He's never had the love that, say, his brother William had with his wife, or his younger brothers had, that him and his sister Alice were isolated in that way, and that it's been an enormous sacrifice to have made
for whatever he had achieved within his art, or indeed whatever glamour he'd achieved in his life or freedom he'd achieved in his life. It was a price to pay.
There are so many other ways to read the story, and over the years, I mean, it's always new. Sometimes it reads like a closeted homosexual who didn't do what Oscar Wilde did, never fell in love, never admitted the sexual possibility. But it's also much bigger than that. I like to read it now as not a confession of failure, but as a warning to other people. He, after all, had a very rich, incredibly productive artistic life. John Marcher in the story wastes his life. I mean, there's nothing at the end. It also seems to me it's a story of the stories we make up. John Marcher had manufactured this incredible kind of cocktail conversation about, oh, I can't reach out to you because this event is going to happen. A gentleman wouldn't take a woman on a safari that's going to, you know, like the one that I'm on. And I noticed that so many people in the world then and now do this. We're all making up stories to limit our possibility.
I don't think James was a moralist or interested in giving advice to people about how they should live their lives.
Really?
I also don't think his sexuality came directly into his stories. There was so much artistry and self-effacement involved in everything he did in his art that who he was in certain ways has not fully affected his art. So it may have been his homosexuality, except our problem is that since it isn't mentioned, we have to read a great deal into the story from his biography to know this. But he was not he was interested in telling stories rather than telling us how to live, I think.
I agree he's not telling about himself. This is not a story about himself, I guess, is the main point. I guess I do read it more as a caution about the stories we tell ourselves. You clarify in this book, as I've never read before, the case that, in a way, Henry James betrayed three women in his life, including his sister buried here, but also Minnie Temple, his cousin, who became Isabel Archer in a way, and who became Millie Teal in The Wings of the Dove, and also this woman, Wolfson. Spell that out. Oliver Wendell Holmes accused him, in effect, of letting Minnie Temple down. Constance Wolfson seems to have killed herself after she asked Henry James to come and join her in Venice, and with all of them the answer was, no, I have my work to do.
Henry James did what any young man would do if allowed the chance to go to Italy. He went alone. He had a great deal to do. He was very ambitious. He wanted to see the country. He wanted to learn the language. He wanted to observe the place. And he wanted to write. Now, he had a tubercular cousin who essentially was dying, who said to him, God, I'd love to go with you. Oh, God, if I went next year, you know, would you see me? And, of course, he knew his mother would have gone crazy if he had agreed to do anything with her. She had no money of her own. She had no possibility, really, of ever going to Italy. But she did write him the letters, and she did talk about it. Oh, if only I could go with Harry the way he's going to Italy. And he was ruthless, as any young man like that will be who's very ambitious. He's not going to mind an invalid. You know, he's not going to wheel her around Rome. He's going to see Rome himself. No member of his family has ever been in Italy. And Italy makes an enormous difference to him, both as a man and as an artist. And he doesn't take her there. Now, but of course, after she dies, everybody goes through, oh, was there a way Minnie could have been saved? And the rumour begins, oh, Harry could have taken her to Italy, and he didn't, he refused. Oh, she wrote letters about it. That's the first one. What would you do if you had a sister like Alice James, who in her teens began to scream in bed, began to have breakdowns all the time, who really his life couldn't be brought back together again under any circumstances? He travelled with her for a certain time with his Aunt Kate. They realised they couldn't travel with her forever. She loved travelling with them. She needed somehow her childhood back with her clever brothers, the family table, the union of the family. The outside world really frightened her. And I suppose she was another reason why he went to England, to get away from that turmoil within the family, which she seemed to be the victim, but the victim that no one seemed to be able to help. She arrived in England then for the last 8 years of her life after her father's death to sort of be with him. And he managed very well to evade that responsibility. In other words, he saw her sometimes, he kept in touch with her. He never really fell out with her, but he certainly didn't wheel her around or nurse her. And In the third case of Constance Fenimore Woolston, it's the saddest one because they really were constant companions. She was a great reader of his work. She was a great listener to everything he said. They both loved Italy. She came to England. They saw one another sometimes over 24 hours in a place like Chester in England. They would meet like that. They would correspond. He lived in her house in Florence for a while when he was lonely. He certainly used her character in the story of the Aspern papers. But he didn't wish to marry her, as she didn't wish to marry him. Their relationship would have remained unstructured and strange. And of course included the possibility that should he wish to work, stay in London, and she was in Venice, he had the absolute right to do so. He had no actual contract with her, even an informal one. But of course, when she committed suicide in Venice, not having seen him for some months, he hadn't responded to her in the way that she wanted. Her melancholy and unhappiness were certainly increased by his not being available. Certainly, everyone around her believed that Henry James had some implication in causing her melancholy, which caused her suicide. Now, in all three cases, you have wonderful material for a historians of women who have not reached their full potential, such as Alice James, you know, whose diaries are interesting, whose letters are interesting, but she certainly wasn't as important a writer as her brother William or her brother Henry. But nonetheless, she remains a fascinating character. And similarly with Constance Fenimore Woolston, who was a minor American writer, and therefore suddenly of enormous interest now, where minor American writers, women of that period, are very rare and strange and interesting. So that the accusations against James have come in recent years. They're terribly interesting because they preyed on his mind very much in his life. He can be very easily defended, but it's also easy to accuse him. So he's locked in that game of being defended and accused. That remains for me very interesting, that business, the ambiguous relationship he had with so many people, where he was ready to close his door one moment to be accused the next.
It's so wonderful when you speak of Minnie Temple saying, "Harry, I want to go to Rome with you." Not just these women, it's us readers too. There's a lure of Henry James. It would be incredible to go to Rome with Harry, or Paris, or to hang in his house in Rye there. I wish you'd just talk for all of us about the lure of Henry James. What is it we love about this man?
I think certain novels have survived everything. The Portrait of a Lady, The Wings of the Dove, The Golden Bowl, The Ambassadors, perhaps The Europeans, The Bostonians, certain short stories. So that it is the work which matters more than anything. The life seemed to me, when I started reading the book, seemed to me nothing, that he had no life, that he at a certain point went to live in England, where he eventually moved out of London, having dined a great deal there, and known people in society, and he moved to Rye, where he lived very quietly, and he got on with his work, and he died in his bed in his 70s, and there was no adventure. He didn't go to sea like Joseph Conrad, or run away like James Joyce with a chambermaid in a hotel to Trieste. There was no obvious emotional turmoil. And then, of course, when you start working on him, you start reading about him, you start reading the letters of his family, you realize no one's life is like that. And his more than any, especially in relation to all of these people who are buried here or remembered here in this graveyard, he had an intense and difficult relationship with most of them. His relationship with William, they were so close in age. And then William was so athletic, was ruining lawns, knocking over fences, while Harry was inside, watching from a window. I have them later where, you know, if you've an older brother, he's always turning the pages of the book before you finish to read them, and he won't turn back. And then he runs out and you watch him, so naturally ready for the world. And Henry James was never naturally ready for the world. So his relationship with William is a difficult and ambiguous one. The love between them was intense, and the rivalry between them was intense, and sometimes quite bitter. There are quite bitter moments of correspondence. He loved William's wife, Alice. He found her a most even-tempered and sensible individual, and he admired that in people enormously. His relationship with his sister, Alice, was that he felt, I think, they'd both been abandoned somehow in England for those 8 years she was there and he was there, both living alone, both of them having been sort of left out of the family in some way or other. And he felt very sorry for her. He admired her wit. He was appalled by her diaries, the indiscretion, because he was a most discreet person and reticent. He couldn't believe that she had listened to stories he told written them in her diaries, and the diaries were published, of course, without permission of either Henry or William by her friend Miss Loring. She only published a few copies, but nonetheless they were around, and he lived in dreadful fear that some of his English friends would see them and realize that he was gossiping about them all the time. There's a memorial tablet here for Billy James, William's son, and Peggy. And, you know, he loved those American kids, so polite, so redolent of an old Boston that, of course, he loved and wrote about. And they loved him. And he got enormous kick out of their arrivals and their departures. And, of course, they had this strange old Anglophile uncle living in Rye with, you know, dogs and servants and his daily habits being written in stone, like their names are all written in stone now, that he would go to his summer house and he would dictate his novels in the morning, write letters at night, and he could go for a walk. He even had a bicycle into his 60s because the land around there was flat. And he would cycle around. And of course, he was a very careful host. Well, I just want to say something else about these graves. I suppose that the most important figure here is Henry James Sr. His father was the second richest man in New York State when he died, after Mr. Astor. But none of his children would go into trade or get involved in business. Some of them drank a lot, they gambled. And this man here, Henry James Sr., became a free thinker. He became one of the greatest talkers of the age. He was friends in England with Carlyle, with Thackeray. Here he was friends with Emerson and Thoreau. Everybody loved him. He had a strange inability to finish anything. He made one great statement, really, that he was visited, really, by the devil or by some aspect of the devil in Windsor Park, where they had rented a house when Henry and William were babies. And he said that he was visited by the obscure bird of night, came to the window and visited him. So that phrase, the obscure bird of night, is his best-known phrase. But his main thing really was that he wrote articles which no one really wanted to publish. He made sermons no one really wanted to hear. And in general, he was a great dilettante. And he was a great example, in a way, to William and Henry. Finish everything you start. They're both of them are very, very good at that business. There's almost nothing left incomplete. Henry's novels are beautifully structured, so that they always have to be finished in that way. There's a real finish, polish about his work. So they both reacted to their father, reacted negatively by producing finished masterpieces in both of their fields. He prevaricated. If he wanted to go back to France, he invented an excuse why his whole family should go back to France. He desperately didn't want either of them to go to university, even though they both studied in Harvard. William ended up studying medicine in Harvard, and Henry did law for a year, but he thought a university education would destroy them. He wanted them not to be a doctor or a lawyer, but to be in the world in a way which would be constantly flickering, ready for change, ready for openness. And both of them resisted that hugely. Once they got the slightest chance, they became one thing and one thing only, as a way of avoiding the dreadful influence of Henry James Sr., which was to move constantly across the Atlantic regularly. But he also had a wonderful phrase which has mattered to me a lot. He said that he really wished to take his children to France at a certain point because he felt their sensuous education was not being looked after properly in America. I love that phrase. No one ever looked after, when I was a kid, my sensuous education. And I'd love to have had a father who cared about your sensuous education. What a marvelous idea. And then he produced these two, I mean, at least two very sensuous sons, in the way they dealt with language, is constantly about the pleasure. Even William, at his most, you know, dry, writes beautifully, sometimes more beautifully than Henry does.
Well, yeah, the results that they got are simply knockout. When you think, at the end of your book, William is in Henry's house preparing the lectures that will become The Varieties of Religion and Experience, published in 1902. I just imagine, you know, somebody saying, well, Mr. and Mrs. James, what have your little boys been doing? Well, William just wrote The Varieties of Religious Experience. And what about Henry? Well, yes, he just wrote a novel called The Wings of the Dove. Is there anything like this in the world?
Yes, there is. In Ireland, the Yeats brothers, W.B. Yeats and Jack Yeats, had a father, John Butler Yeats, who really hated finishing things too. He was a great talker.
Interesting.
Was a friend of everyone of the age, and he produced two sons. Yeats's poems have the same idea. They finish on a rhyme. You know, he sculpted his poems in the same way, and Jack became a great painter. And they brothers were rivals, but they were certainly, everything they did, they finished in the same way. It is very unusual. And it happened here with the Jameses, and it happened in Ireland with the Yeatses, almost in the same way. But the mother becomes very important in the story because Henry had, quite an uncomplicated relationship with her, which William didn't have. In other words, I think he was her favorite baby. And there's a marvelous letter she writes to him where his father has been writing, saying, "You're spending too much money in Italy." And she says, "No, no, spend more. Spend all you want. You must spend money. Please spend our money." And always there's a great, when he writes about her life after she dies, a great tenderness in describing her. Quite an uncomplicated business. Although he has some mothers in his work, he never has, I don't think he ever puts her into his novels. Somehow the memory was too pure and too beautiful. And he, you know, he longed for her all his life, really.
One more word about William, because the love between the brothers is so strong and devoted. And yet, William really was the father of the notion that became sort of the orthodox line on Henry, that, you know, he wrote The Portrait of a Lady and then disappeared to England and frittered away a great talent with these unreadable novels. And you make it a dialogue, but I think it's actually quite there in letters, in which he says, basically, little brother, you blew it. And it took years of rethinking, especially those last three novels, to realize, holy moly, he hit home run after home run, long after William had given up on him.
I think the problem starts in that date, December the 18th, 1882, we're looking at here, which is the date of the death of Henry James Sr. William is in England, and he's longed to come back to be at his father's bedside. But William's wife and William's sister say, "Don't come back, we don't want you back. He can't talk, you'll be able to do nothing. Stay in England." William stays in England and misses the funeral. Henry is travelling at the time, and he arrives in Boston the day after his father is buried. Now, if you look at the date, it's December the 18th. He didn't need to be buried quickly. But Alice, the sister, has taken control in the family now, and she buries him almost to spite Henry the day before he arrives and when William is away. The father, oddly enough, has left Henry to be his executor. And he owns quite a lot of things, in a lot of railway shares, and including the town of Syracuse. So Henry has to go and organize all that. He's also left one of the family, Wilkie, out of his will. Henry has to go and organize the inclusion of Wilkie in the will. William in London is writing Henry the most vicious letters about how much he hates London, how much he hates Henry's apartment, how much he wants to come back, how much he won't give Wilkie his money. And William is being like a child, suddenly realizing Henry has got power now. Alice has got power. Alice has moved out of the house. Henry is living with his Aunt Kate in the house, suddenly taking over his father's role, sort of growing into it. William eventually comes back like a thunderbolt, and Henry actually realizes, I will not continue this fighting with him. And there's been a lot of hectoring letters saying, you know, it would be idle of you to come back so suddenly from England. You must stay there. Henry, as is sort of talking like his father to William. William arrives back, and Henry just says to him, you do it. You take over as executive. You look after it all. I'm giving my share of this vast fortune to my sister Alice, just so she'll be very comfortable. I live on my work, actually. And goes back to England. And it's only one of the things that happened, the death of the baby Herman, which happens, you can see, in 1884, softens the relationship, because Henry feels so sorry for William and his wife with the death of their infant baby, and the correspondence begins to soften. But one of the things that particularly irritates William is that William, as his father is dying, writes his father a long, beautiful letter about his father. He hopes he could see him again in the future. If only there was an afterlife, they would all be happy. And the letter arrives, and the father is already dead. But Henry sees this letter for Henry James at the address, so he opens it, realizing halfway down it is not for him. So without consulting anybody, in the deep winter, I think around Christmas Day or the day after, so the father is dead a week, Henry James comes to this cemetery. He's covered in snow, it's freezing, and he stands here at this spot, and he reads the letter out loud to his father. And his sister-in-law is living quite close. He goes to see her. He tells her, he writes a letter to William to say, look what I've done to you. I read your letter out loud to our father. William, of course, isn't pleased at all. William doesn't think this was a great gift, you know, Henry doing this. Henry has, first of all, opened the letter without permission and read it without permission. So those days around the father's death as to who will now fill the vacuum of power in the family becomes the beginning of the row, which ends as a row about Henry James's prose style and William thinking that some of those sentences have to be read 10 times, and even then they don't yield meaning. And Henry saying back to William, "I know the writers you admire, and I would rather go to a disgraced grave than write like those people that you admire." So the row, it is a row but it's Cain and Abel as much as anything else.
God, you bring us close to these men as men, but I'm still wondering what it is about the men, but particularly Henry the artist, that drew you deep into this work and that is still just so awe-inspiring for those who do read the sentences 10 times and say, "My God, it's perfect."
I think you begin by admiring the work, and I really admire the work. But then I found that the life is so ambiguous and so interesting. His relation to his family is constantly in a state of flux. He himself, in terms of London, say, in London he longs to go out. He knows society. He gets enormous numbers of stories from duchesses and archbishops. But he also longs to be alone. He never longs for the same thing twice. You know, in other words, the next day he wants something else. He's a very fluid and mysterious character. His sexuality remains mysterious. I mean, what sort of erotic life he must have had, or dream life, remains entirely mysterious. It's a pre-Freudian existence, as Freud is coming into vogue. It's a pre-Wildian existence, as Wilde is coming into vogue. And his exile is also strange, the way in which he never really wrote about England, I don't think, very well. His English characters don't work for me. And yet he couldn't write about a settled Boston, the Boston of the Metaphysical Club. That was lost to him too. So he realized in the last years, having written, I think, quite bad books, in my view, such as The Spoils of Point or The Other House.
Sacred Fount.
Yeah, The Sacred Fount, that it could actually go now and describe Americans in Europe again. The disruptive arrival of a Chad and Strater in The Ambassadors, the disruptive arrival of Millie Thiel in The Wings of the Dove, and the disruptive arrival of the millionaires in Adam Verber and his daughter Maggie in The Golden Bowl, that he could deal with the disruptive arrival of Americans whose wealth or whose ambitions would hit against an older and much more duplicitous society. And he knew about duplicity, he knew about secrecy. There's really no George Eliot novel in which a secret, if told, will be explosive, in which people behave duplicitously towards each other. People behave badly towards each other, but never in the way that happens in James. It's a constant in James. Secrecy, duplicity, someone being someone they're pretending not to be, or being, you know, the opposite. And so, as an artist, he remains, not only the way he wrote, but the type of stories he wrote speak to us still, or speak to me still anyway, and they get maybe into movies, which movies don't interest me very much, but with the way in which those stories still remain really important stories for us now. But his life has lived the level of industry, the level of care taken with work, and the amount of secret suffering and secret glamour, from the going to Italy, the hanging out in Venice, the living in palaces, the constant sense of economic freedom as well that he had.
Could I humbly add one more thing to that whole business of artifice and deception and duplicity? For me, the most wonderful and redemptive thing I love about Henry James is that in the end, he's so forgiving. With Kate Croy, for example, in The Wings of the Dove, she's really setting up a trap for money to bail her love out, and it's a dreadful thing in a certain way, and yet it's told so lovingly, and at every level James is looking for understanding and not making excuses either, but he's somewhere between, it seems to me, very orthodox Christianity. He's saying, you know, bad as you are, you're not that bad, and you're a child of God, and you're forgiven. And at the same time, he's also sort of anticipating brain science in getting into the unbelievable complexity of actually how the neurons travel. You know, I mean, nobody's outdone him, including brain science, in that department.
I think he was very good on the subject of moral ambiguity, that people who, in someone else's story, if Dickens wrote them or George Eliot wrote them, they would be there for us to condemn. And someone like Kate Croy, as you said in The Wings of the Dove, somebody who really is evil in what she does, is presented by James as someone who actually doesn't quite mean as much harm as that suggests, who on a daily basis, as she makes these decisions to do this, it isn't done out of pure badness, but there's always badness there. And when innocence hits a sort of readiness to be bad in James, it creates a conflagration that he really writes very well about, so that the person who's being bad is capable of coming across as fully redeemed by the end of the book,
exactly,
despite continuing to behave badly. That is a great gift, somebody. I love the fact that there's no moralizing spirit. His father did all the moralizing for the family that kept them going all their lives. He wanted no more moralizing, and he very much was careful in his books never to do so.
I want to talk about the movie. I mean, a lot of people have compared your book on Henry James to Michael Cunningham's book, The Hours, on Virginia Woolf. And I wonder, I mean, there's got to be a movie in this book, and I'd love you to cast it.
I really live in a world where movies are dying, where,
right,
you know, people used to think the novel is dying, but the movies are dying in that there are 10 movies on all over the world. Troy is on in every city in the world as we speak. It's very bad. I haven't seen it. I won't. And there are about 9 other worse movies on in those same multiplex cinemas all over the world. And so I haven't. When was the last time you saw a good film? So I have.
Wings of the Dove, I thought it was a good movie. You know, there have been some good movies. Mr. Grimm is a good movie. Have you seen it? Lost in Translation is a good movie.
You really have to work at going to them. I mean, you're much better at home, really, than going to a movie.
Let's cast it, though. Who's your actor to play Henry James?
John Malkovich.
Possible. Anthony Hopkins comes to mind.
James is in his 50s here.
Too young for Hopkins.
Well, I don't think Hopkins is in his 50s, is he?
I don't know.
I lose touch. I'm just living in my own world these days. I lose touch with all that.
John Malkovich played Gilbert Osmond in Portrait of a Lady, of course. But no, you know, I would also suggest, this is maybe impossible, but Sean Connery for Henry James. He's a little old for this period. But he's tough, and Henry is tough. I mean, to me, the notion of Henry as the sort of the teacup twit is just so wrong. He was hard as rock, and a demon for work, and absolutely resolved on his purpose.
There's a marvelous poem by Anthony Hecht where he's trying to talk about contemporary America and find a proper image for it, and it's very simple. Charlton Heston playing Socrates.
Any other candidates to play Henry O. Williams?
Charlton Heston, he's still alive.
Yeah, absolutely.
And we'll have him.
Protecting your gun.
We'll have him.
Would you like it to become a movie?
I write novels. I stick to my guns on that matter. I'm involved in what is a sort of lonely, you know, business. And I'm not that interested in it. You know, it's not a big deal for me.
Have you got Henry James out of your system yet?
No. No, I'd love to go back now and just read some of the novels again. And I must say, being here, you know, all of these people were really provided the world with an extraordinary thing, which were the novels of Henry, Alice's Diaries. We should remember also that the two younger brothers fought in the American Civil War. They fought in the 1st African-American Regiment, with the 1st African-American Regiment.
Sort of a cannon fodder in the family.
Yeah, and that... Henry's novels, all Williams' writings, the extraordinary volume of correspondence, even the old father's writings, some of them are still interesting, Alice's writings. And so we are standing on hallowed ground, and that should be remembered, and it's very rare.
Amen. You've written a wonderful, wonderful book, The Master. Thank you, Colm Tóibín, for joining us.
Thank you.
And thank you to all the James family for making this occasion possible. Thank you all.
Paul McCarthy edited these conversations with Colm Tóibín. Please post up your own reading and writing adventures, with or without a Henry James connection, at our website, radioopensource.org. I'm Christopher Lydon. Thank you for joining us.